Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the studios of KSFR and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We are podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. I'd like now to welcome John Allen. He is a systems ecologist and engineer. He's a thinker, metallurgist, adventurer, and writer. His new book is called Me and the Biospheres, a memoir by the inventor of Biosphere 2, published by Synergetic Press here in Santa Fe, New Mexico. And he will be speaking at Garcia Street Books this Friday, February 27th, from 5 to 6 in the afternoon. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
So let's talk about the term biosphere, first of all. What does it mean, and when did you first hear it?
Well, I first heard it at Colorado School of Mines, studying historical geology. And the biosphere is the complete mass composition and volume of life around the planet Earth, or geosphere. Many people think that biospherics is a study of individual plants or animals, but it's a study of the total system, actually.
So it's such an interesting concept that you learned at the Colorado School of Mines at that moment, which was these concentric spheres starting at the center of the Earth and going all the way out into the atmosphere.
That's right. So that's fundamentally a gravitational closure. The mantle's the heaviest, or the core is the heaviest, and then the mantle, and then you have the continental and the ocean. And on that mantle, which was formed about 4.5 billion years ago, after 700 million years, about, as far as we know now, life started making another sphere because it had to adapt to the spherical shape of the Earth.
So one of the things that really struck me about this book, and it's a wonderful read for probably people in many different fields. It's not something that you need to be a scientist or somebody who's interested in botany or life sciences or whatever to appreciate. And one of the things that really struck me was that at a very early age, you took your own education in your own hands and studied in a systematic way completely different disciplines successively. Tell us about that process, how you came to it, how you did it.
Well, number one, I was dissatisfied with the school system sitting in there, or reading at random, which my family had something in the library. And I ran across this book by Alexis Carrel, who was a physiologist and that. And he was talking about his regrets in his life that he hadn't mastered the total system of knowledge. Well, of course, master doesn't mean that you know every detail. But anyway, he suggested that if a person would spend 2 years and become proficient in field A, that there were only about 10 basic fields. So in 20 years, you would have a basic comprehension of what went on. That used to be basically the idea of what was called a classical education. But the classical education broke apart because science came in, and so people started to specialize out in science away from the classics. So he introduced a way, I thought, that you could make a classical education for yourself by doing that. So
And you started that as a teenager.
Yeah, at 14, actually. And then also from the American tradition, or the frontier tradition, it was that you didn't just do it, as he was suggesting, study intellectual subjects, but you also went out and had field experience. So I took off then and worked for a summer in California, and then back, and then I would study something, and then so I would alternate back and forth between so-called real life and intellectual life.
And it's interesting, too, because you grew up in Oklahoma, and as you describe in the book, there was a kind of heady intellectual side of the family, and then there was a very down-to-earth side of the family, and you really learned as much as you could from both sides.
Well, yes. Oklahoma was, which means home of the red man, was a Jacksonian state. That is to say, it was actually a state that was formed from an idea. So my family were Jeffersonians, and Jefferson was himself a comprehensively educated man. So education was extremely big in Oklahoma. They only made one fatal, almost fatal mistake. They plowed up the Great Plains, and so a lot of Oklahoma blew away. So that Oklahoma you wouldn't find anymore. And I grew up actually in the middle of that. The Depression was with the Dust Bowl. But that in itself, the Dust Bowl, showed how fragile a human system could be. Even if you were expert people and hardworking, like people in Oklahoma were, still, if you disturbed that balance and the soil started blowing away, so Oklahoma lost nearly 1 million people, had to migrate basically to California.
Learning to understand complex systems and chaos theory is a major part of what you did in creating Biosphere 2, and we'll get to a moment what Biosphere 2 is and was. But understanding a complex system, that the Earth is, that the biosphere is a complex system, is something that is very important and that we don't do in this country a lot of the time or in this world. And you talk in many different places in the book about the dangers and hazards of reductionist thinking.
Yes, of course. Reductionist thinking, which is that there's five major branches of science. One is what is called the falsifiable hypothesis one. That's the reductionist. You have the first and basic science is naturalist observation. You have to actually observe. And, of course, for a long time, people didn't even think there was a thing like nature. They thought there were spirits and all sorts of other forces. So so when you reduce the wealth or plethora of observations that you make by observing something, that's what is reduced to is the hypothesis. And of course, hypotheses can build up a tremendous amount of data, but eventually you always have to return back to the field, and that field is always a complex system.
Now, you said a moment ago there are five branches of science. What are those five branches?
Well, there's five ways to do science, I should say. One is naturalist observation.
Which is what Charles Darwin did.
Yeah. And then second is hypothesis-driven science.
What would be an example of a hypothesis?
Well, you could have a hypothesis that, I'll give you sort of a reductio ad absurdum of it. You can say, are people altruist or not? And then you could have a hypothesis that if you give put an electric shock in somebody's hand and somebody over here doing something, that by testing whether they shock them more than they would have to.
Right, the Milgram experiments.
Exactly. So you can get – but that's called science. It's a hypothesis and it's falsifiable, at least within the random sample. So then you can get thousands of these going, but you just get deeper and deeper into what, for really understanding nature, is a small amount. You have to go back and take broader observation. Then there's systems science. And systems science commences once you divide whatever you're looking at least two. And then you can take that into three, into four, into five. It's more complex. For example, Biosphere 2, we put in seven biomes. So that was a system with seven major components, plus three or four major technical components. So that was a complex system. Then there's when you model. So you can do a computer model. The Institute of Complexity here at Santa Fe, for example, are experts in the field of complex computer systems and seeing what kind of knowledge you get from that.
Santa Fe Institute.
Yes, the Institute. And the fifth one is physical models. So Biosphere 2 actually had all of those. We had the computer modeling. We had the physical model where you had the enclosure. The enclosure substituted for the gravitational field. The gravitational field holds Biosphere 1, the one we're in.
So Biosphere 1, just to step back for a minute, Biosphere 1 is where we live. It's planet Earth and the air we breathe and the soil and the water and
just what where we're
plants
in,
and animals.
Even in this room.
Biosphere 2 is a piece of land just over 3 acres, completely sealed and enclosed, in which you put in components of the world's ecosystems, and people lived in it, in the sealed environment, for a couple of years.
Yeah, and not only just components, but this was seven, what you might consider the basic biomes.
Now, what is a biome?
A biome is could be looked at as the major organ. For example, you look at the human being and we say there's a heart, the lungs, and of course you could break that down into cells and so forth. So a biome is the first division below the biosphere that you would look at. For example, in the United States, there's the Great Plains, the grassy plains. There's a southern forest biome. There's the desert biome. There's a mountain biome. And in mountains, in fact, you can have several representative biomes because of the change of elevation. So basically, biomes are a climatic range in which a certain life system, fundamentally grasses or bushes or trees, grows.
And so it's a subsystem that is self-contained in some ways but interacts with the larger system.
That's right. But the biome has a special significance because practically all of the phylum, all of the kingdoms are in a biome of life. So it's very representative. In fact, some people, some scientists believe, particularly the Russians who work with it, that every biome contains a potential biosphere. It's just limited because of the climate. And you can see things, for example, in West Africa, the tree line of the forest ends like here, and you step out here and you're in the grass, you can't see the end of it. So sometimes biomes are sharply demarcated. Sometimes, like here around Santa Fe, they aren't. They have what we call ecotones, where there's a small little area between biomes that...
it's a gradual boundary.
And those are very interesting. We put ecotones also into biosphere too, because they're the areas that some people think would be the height of evolutionary fervor, because you have species from two or three different biomes going.
What was the concept in the first place? Why did you want to make a sealed environment which would not exactly replicate the Earth's biosphere, but come to a greater understanding of it?
Well, to understand the biosphere, you have to use system science. Now, it's difficult to study biosphere one because it's so big. So by making a smaller one, you can study many, many different things in it very accurately. So fundamentally, it was the fifth branch of science, a physical model, and then see what was the relation between CO2, for example, and oxygen. People were quite concerned about that now, plus nitrous oxide, plus all of the other elements. And in biosphere 2, you could actually measure everything. So for the first time, there was data about what actually went on in this. For example, many people said, when we started to do it, off of the hypotheses that they were expert in a small area, oh, this is impossible. The ocean, in fact, was declared dead by one expert because he knew it ought to be. Why? Because the CO2 content went up to 3,000 to 4,000. It alternated, fluctuated regularly, just like the one does out here. And so that would have made the ocean acid, and they thought the coral reef would die. So you could study then, let's say, different kinds of equilibrium stability in different biomes.
So you actually had a coral reef inside of Biosphere 2.
Yeah. That was a number of very interesting expeditions to do that. And also some scientists use that. For example, Dr. Dustin in South Carolina, who looks at the U.S. reefs around Florida, helped us design a method to actually measure a coral reef in detail. And then we participated in a study for 15 years after Biosphere 2, studying coral reefs around the planet with Dr. Dustin's method, which now lots of people use.
What is the importance of a coral reef to the Biosphere 1, to the ecosystem in which we live on Earth?
Well, the importance, my first frame of reference is right now, by association, aesthetic. They're certainly one of the most beautiful ones, but they are extremely interesting also because they form a refuge for different sea animals to breed. So that's a refuge. The small fish are there, and they get bigger. They grow out around the rest of the ocean. There's a tremendous interplay. And also they show, along with the rainforest, they were two essential biomes to put in there, I thought, because they are the two richest biomes. And by the way, I think it's quite applicable by analogy to human economics. They're on the poorest soil.
Right, the rainforest.
And the soil, coral reef. A blue sea is like the red clay in a tropical forest. It means there's nothing there, or very little sustenance for life there.
Yeah, if you can see through it, that means there's nothing in it.
That's right. Or you can't see it all through it, like at the red clay. So what that means is that they have to make themselves extremely rich in order to survive in a poverty-stricken environment. So the coral reef does that by enclosing itself. So a molecule that gets in there goes around and around and around and around before it gets out again. And in the rainforest, a leaf drops. They can't afford to lose it. So the tree puts out little roots and eats up its own leaf. It comes back. All sorts of little tricks like that. So they are a real study within the complex biosphere. The two ultimate complex systems are coral reefs and rainforests.
And you had both of those in this 3-acre footprint enclosed piece of land.
Yeah. Well, see, that was another very – so much knowledge came out of biosphere. So much knowledge went into it because, for example, what is the size that's actually sustainable of a rainforest, of a coral reef, and within what parameters is it sustainable? You know, you could have sustainable, say, with a 10% species loss, or 20% or whatever. So this whole point of reduction in scale and how that affects species, all of these are really important issues today. And by part of Biosphere 2 was at least we'd have 2 points, Biosphere 1 and Biosphere 2. And then you could check, well, here's the rainforest here and here's the rainforest there and so forth and so on.
We're talking to John Allen. He's the author of the new book, Me and the Biospheres, a memoir by the inventor of Biosphere 2. So it's kind of like a space mission, and the training of the 8 people who went on the first 2-year, was it called a mission, were trained almost the way astronauts are trained.
Well, actually, we had a lot of good consulting from astronauts, notably Joe Allen and Rusty Schweikert, because our training was considered by many astronauts to be quite similar in intensity with theirs. So there was, and we called the corporation that ran it Space Biospheres Ventures. Not necessarily the Biosphere 2 could be taken to space in that way, but
it does make you think when you're reading it, gee, could you put one of these on Mars?
Yeah, and certainly the big question is if we're not going to just take a picnic lunch and come back from Mars, sooner or later you have to put a life system there. Though undoubtedly it would begin to be by much smaller than the – in fact, we're doing that – continuing those experiments today. What is the smallest volume that people could get by with on an outpost, say, on Mars or the moon? By the way, the Chinese, Russians, and Japanese are also extremely interested in that.
So the idea was to – I mean, what was it? What were you hoping to achieve? I mean, the so much, as you say, knowledge went into that, including, which we'll talk about in a moment, cultural knowledge as well as scientific knowledge. But what was the idea? What did you want to achieve by doing this experiment?
Well, a big driver for me, going back to the original thing of self-education, was to educate myself. I had a lot of questions about biospheres, and I really wanted to understand it. And I think this is a good way to design model experiments, by the way, is you have somebody who's really interested in something. And for example, I spent years traveling around planet Earth and tramping around the biomes and sailing over the biomes here. And then somebody gets an idea they really want to understand that area. And then what you do, that attracts other people who are particularly interested. So basically, Biosphere 2 got designed by people who were really interested in biospherics. For example, the Odom, Howard Odom and Gene Odom, who actually formed Ecosystem Science. And they were two chief advisors on that.
They formed the whole field of ecosystem science.
That's right. And Dr. Schultes at Harvard, who was a specialist on the, if you can call it, it's so generalist you could hardly call it a specialist, on the Amazon rainforest. So they would get very interested, or like Dr. Dustin on coral reefs and Walter Ady at the Smithsonian. And so these people who were really into biomic studies and biospheric studies were attracted. And so basically that's how we designed it, was something that would interest people who really already knew a lot and wanted to understand what they knew and to know even more.
One thing that is also very interesting to me about reading your memoir is that you always worked outside of, although you consulted with, but worked outside of academic institutions. And that was probably both a tremendous intellectual help in the sense that you were completely free, but also a hindrance in terms of credibility and funding and things like that.
Well, you see, credibility and funding are what hang up American intellectuals. They've been totally brainwashed. Totally brainwashed, in my opinion. Credibility means belief. So number one, you need to have a credo, a belief in yourself and your colleagues. Number two, you need to have capital. Now, capital is different than funding. Capital means you set up a corporation, and then the corporate body makes a decision how to apply that money. If you go to funding, I'm not against funding. In many cases, government is the right thing to do. But if you're doing something original, it's much better to have a corporation than funding and raise capital.
Right, right. So you raised capital rather than getting nonprofit funding or whatever. But then, I mean, is it still seen as science? Is it seen as art? Is it seen as a grand social experiment by an individual?
Well, sure. See, capital is two things. One that is, it's gigantic capitalist institutions like banks. And the other thing, it's Schumpeter pointed this out, you know, that Marx and Adam Smith left out something, land, labor, and capital. They left out entrepreneurs. So entrepreneurial capital is the capital I'm talking about, where you set up an enterprise, and that enterprise then, if its aim is to profit maximize, then say you could eventually build that into a huge corporation. You see that all the time. Microsoft will buy up an enterprise and then integrate it into the big system. In this particular case, none of us who founded that corporation wanted to sell it out. We were interested in our own returns off of it. And that gave us entrepreneurial freedom. And then by going to many different institutions, and to their top professors or top people in the Russian space program or the American space program who had questions, then you had total free intelligentsia thought because they didn't report back to their colleagues.
Yeah, exactly. And there is a kind of, I mean, you write about naysayers and reductionists as people who, on the one hand, did give you, point out some potential problems and were helpful in that ways. But on the other hand, if you'd had to report to them, you might not have gotten anywhere.
That's the difference. Now, I'm not against reductionist science. I'm a metallurgist. I've worked in the uranium industry, beryllium, stainless steel. And it works on that, where you have a specific problem. How do we want to increase the strength of stainless steel? Is it best to have 1% more of nitrogen in it or 1.01%? So there's no anti-reductionist in it at all. It's just, as you just said, you don't want to report to a reductionist. On the other hand, you don't want to really report to any one of those five branches of science. So one of the things Biosphere 2 did was it selected out people who could operate in the entire field of science. So we had people working with us who were in the National Academy of Science, the National Academy of Engineering, the Soviet Academy, which now became the Russian Academy of Sciences, the Royal Society in UK, et cetera, et cetera. But they were people who didn't, who had escaped. They were specialists in some field, but they had escaped that, and they were interested in the general, the overall problem.
We're talking to John Allen, author of Me and the Biospheres, a memoir by the inventor of Biosphere 2. We're going to take a very brief break right now. We'll be right back. We're back with John Allen. Let's go to another very interesting part of the book, which is the thread throughout your life of theater and poetry.
Oh, yeah.
And these are disciplines which, for you, are integrated with everything else, metaphysics, the physical world, theater, human relations, that you don't being the systems thinker that you are, you include all of those, which of course is very important if you're going to make a sealed system that people have to live in for a couple of years.
Well, not only that, after all, science or the world we see around us was basically created in Athens and Elizabethan London, and Medici in Florence. In other words, the Renaissance or Athens, and that was called looking at the total. Their idea was to look at the total picture. So Newton, for example, was master of the mint. He studied Kabbalah. He was a great physicist. He invented calculus, and he was president and organizer of the Royal Society. And he, you know, had to participate in discussions on everything that they discussed there. Francis Bacon, who created modern science, was, of course, a colleague of Shakespeare and the entire panoply there. So I think that this is also something like that is needed to maximize creativity.
So what has been the role of theater and poetry and art in your life and in combining that with everything else you do?
Well, see, I think we humans have like three different ways of operating. One is functionally, like if you just had me adjust the way that I'm talking into this thing.
Right.
So that's functional. And then second is like consciousness, because you were very clever. You did that without breaking the vibrational chain. You know, you could have come down with a harsh reprimand or something like that, or a very straightforward tone of voice. So that's what I would call being. And then there's understanding, that is actually doing something. And so poetry has to do with of course, being and theater. The basis of that is a metaphor, which literally means unbearable. For is bearing, and meta is beyond bearing. Metaphor is unbearable to the logical mind, because a metaphor says A is B.
Right.
But in being, we know that A is B, because we can hold two contradictory things in our mind all the time. And when you hold that and you come down to the world of function, this puts up a tremendous tension, which has to be resolved. So then what you can do there in the world of function, you can say, well, maybe there's a hierarchy, or maybe there's a system, and it works this way and that way. Or take understanding, which would be history. I would say history, art, and science. And when history is basically a step of decisions that take place that make a difference in what's actually being done, where resources are allocated to. So we also, besides the poetry and theater, did historical studies there for that.
It's interesting. There's this moment in the book where you are speaking with a scientist, and he takes you to a play because he knows you like theater, and he doesn't like theater, and he says something like, I like my facts served straight up instead of through theater. And you laughed because you said, but I mean, I don't think you said this to him, but he, that wasn't true, because he loves the drama of the whole space program and all these other dramas that he's involved in. And seeing those supposedly real life things as dramas is kind of a different way of looking at it.
Well, see, that again goes to the specialization that we have in our culture. Because by theater, he was thinking, of course, of Broadway. He was thinking of people that don't have scientific, you know, a specialist in that. But, of course, every human being, I think, is into theater. We all make scenes.
It makes scenes, exactly.
Right? It's even in the she made a scene last night. Well, you should have seen the scene he made in response to her scene.
Right.
And in the Army now, they have theater. Yeah, the police have theater and act out roles. So a lot of that is just a response to the present specialization. It doesn't reflect what a person really feels if you break them out of specialist definitions of the word. In fact, the big thing that attracted so many people of high caliber there was that they didn't have to be specialists there. They were taking part in a historic deal, and they were taking part in theater in a metaphor. Biosphere 2, in a way, is a metaphor, could be looked as a metaphor for Biosphere 1, as well as a science. And it could be looked at as history, because it's essential if we're going to go into space sooner or later. Somebody has to have an enclosed system somebody can live in.
So you were not among the first eight people who went on the crew and lived in Biosphere 2 for a couple of years. But they were trained not only in all the different things. I mean, they did agriculture. They had complete recycling of water and waste. But also they had to learn to get along. And I imagine that even with all the best training in the world, it wasn't easy to live with the same small group of people for all that time.
Yeah. Of course, we did make sure they had electronic communication outside. But you're quite right. I went to a NASA meeting on how people got along. And they said, because, you know, what standard do you mean when somebody gets along? So they said, well, and I said, what's your standard, actually? And so this one lady who was one of their experts in the field said, as long as we don't see black eyes and they eat together, we think it's going great. See, one of the things, Biosphere 2 was open to the public to see everything. You have to remember that other places aren't. And so much is concealed that actually goes on. And what we
in Antarctica or in space capsules.
Yeah, exactly. But a lot does go on. And we nothing bad about it. People do their duty and everything like that and all of that. But we didn't. There was no black eyes that occurred. There was a four of them began to prefer to be the hypothesis-driven science. And four preferred the systems approach. Not many of them actually got all five parts of science, although Dr. Nelson certainly did. And I think all of them had at least a taste of it because they were doing it. They all did a great job. It was fantastic.
And one of the things that did come out of it was that they were all perfectly healthy when they came out.
This was one of the big points, was what is a healthy life in the biosphere? That is, one that the biosphere itself can support and is good for the human being. Now, the first year, they lost a little more weight than we had hoped for, or they had hoped for. The second year, they started to gain it back. However, one of the ladies in there had, for example, done a year's work in Nepal. She actually lost 3 pounds more living in a Nepali village than she did at Biosphere 2. So other people got into quite good fighting trim.
What kind of animal life forms besides humans did you have in there?
Well, that was really interesting decision because every animal takes, lots of biomass to support. But
basically, it needs to eat more than a plant needs to eat.
And also it doesn't produce new plants.
Right.
A plant may eat another plant. That is to say, it destroy its roots, but then it produces new roots as it takes the place. So we had goats, chickens. The goat was an interesting one. We had looked over the planet to find a goat that was the thriftiest and produced the most. And in the Jos Plateau in Nigeria, where we took an expedition, we found this super Nigerian goat.
That produced the most what, milk?
Yeah. And then we thought there should be a primate in there. So then we had between a Galago and a lemur, which are relatively small primates, and decided finally on a Galago. Now, this is interesting because William Burroughs, who was an artistic friend, William got very interested in all this, so he began to learn more science. He went to Duke University and made himself something of an expert on Galagos, which is one we wound up putting in there.
Amazing. I noticed there were no dogs. Domestic pets were really not deemed necessary the first go-around.
No, they didn't have it, though. Although I think the goats became something like that.
So what did you learn from that first two-year experiment?
Well, why 2 years? 2 years because one thing, no matter which kind of science you do of the five or doing all five, you have to have a replicable. It has to be a comparable. Well, in the biosphere, the basic unit is a year because it changes the solar radiation, et cetera, et cetera. So by running 2 years with the same crew and the same setup, then it was as comparable as you can get in something, which is also having a historical development.
And so after 2 years, one thing you learned was that they were all in good health and due to tremendous planning on your part and the part of all the consultants. What else did you learn?
Well, also it showed that, in fact, that the carbon cycle had settled down into equilibrium with the oxygen. And the second year basically retraced the path. So basically it showed that there was a system, a stable system. More than a stable system, it was actually the biomass was increasing. We started out with 15 tons and was 30 tons at the end of the second year. And we had designed...
Meaning the trees grew.
If you added everything that was alive. And the idea or that it was designed to have 60 tons, then that would be the maximum that could hold. That's an interesting... See, we could talk about on Biosphere 1 about that. So, for example, in the ocean, some people point out if you drop iron in some parts, it's an iron deficiency that keeps a lot of the ocean as a desert. So... all of these are issues that or points of interest to the ecological movement.
What does Biosphere 2 tell us about global warming, which is the thing that I think most people are interested in?
Well, global warming you really should go to geology for that. Because you remember, the planet has warmed up before. One time there was no ice left.
Well, I mean, that was so interesting. You said this is Biosphere 2 is an ice-free system, as Biosphere 1 maybe will soon be.
And as it has been in the past. So global warming, one thing Biosphere 2 did was to show that we dealt with all of the... warming gases. Because CO2, there's nitrous oxide and there's methane. Some of these are more dangerous, methane could be more dangerous than CO2. There's huge masses of methane under Siberian soil. If something would overturn that, now N2O.
Like thaw.
Yeah. Nitrous oxide would come up. It is increasing because of the increased nitrogenated agriculture. Nitrous oxide is also a global warmer.
We're talking to John Allen. His book is called Me and the Biospheres, a memoir by the inventor of Biosphere 2. Jumping to a completely different idea just for a moment, one of the things that also really moved me was how you had to expend a lot of energy because, of course, this was a whole process of creating and doing Biosphere 2. It was itself a complex system and was designed as a complex system. And one of the things that you expend a lot of energy doing was preventing perfectionism.
Preventing
perfectionism.
That's right. I learned that from the guy who actually launched one of the space program guys. And he said, perfection is the enemy of the good.
Right.
And this is true. Perfectionists, you see them around everywhere today. It's what we used to call in Oklahoma a nitpicker. Well, you can nitpick anything to death.
Well, there's a place for perfectionism.
There's a place for
if you're putting out a brochure, you don't want it to have typos. But in a big system, why is it bad?
Well, it's because... It isn't. It depends on the scale that you use it on. Remember, it doesn't say that. It just says it's the enemy of the good.
Right.
Well, good brings in a lot of vectors. There's economics. There's people. There's this. So somewhere, you have to make a compromise. For example, let's say what is perfection to an engineer is not perfection to an ecologist. An ecologist are very often happy with the plus or minus 30% variation in the population. If I was to engineer a metal with a plus or minus 30% difference in composition, it would be hopeless. I have to get that down to maybe a thousandth or even a millionth of a percent of something. So when you're dealing with a total complex system, you have these different fields in there, each of which has in that field, that is reduced to that field, you can then get down to these points. But if you're in the total system, you have to somewhere come to an agreement about something. For example, to say, and then you bring in the economics. So there you're talking, say, plus or minus $100 or $1,000. and you started talking about, are you wasting 25 cents, you wouldn't get anywhere.
Right, exactly.
So that's the what it's driving at, that it takes a reasonable approach. What will work? And what will work, and that depends on your objectives.
So you were probably, I mean, you were working among and really cultivating a community of like-minded interdisciplinarians, if you could call it that. But you were probably more like that than anybody else, and you did have a lot of specialists working together. How did you get them to work together when they're not used to doing that?
Interest. A specialist is only a specialist. None of us were born a specialist. So anybody that calls himself a specialist and may actually be a specialist is calling themselves that and reducing themselves to that only because their funding, their income, their social position, or whatever depends on it. But inside, everybody is a human being, and a human being has a total interest in their life. So to get a top specialist, all you have to do is interest them. Aha! Oh, boy, I could do my specialty and get in and see all these other interesting specialists. Most specialists see specialists of the same variety. Oh, I get to meet a specialist in rainforest trees. I get to meet a specialist in soils, a specialist in this, a specialist in that. And they get very interested in it.
What kinds of, I mean, you certainly planned for every eventuality, but of course, there's always unexpected problems that arise. What kind of unexpected problems arose in that first two-year mission?
Well, first, number one, you have to have a team. So we had what they call Biosphere Emergency Response Team, which was really top people dealing with emergencies. So they lived on site. That's one of the reasons we had several people living on site. So there was the BER team could immediately get there. Well, you never know if that's what an emergency means.
I mean, they were living outside the...
Yeah, yeah. So, well, some of the people inside were also on the BERT team.
Okay.
So it could work collaboratively both inside. Well, you have to be prepared for... You're using any kind of equipment... explosions or breakage or sabotage from outside. You just don't know.
But what kind of things actually did happen?
Well, we didn't actually have any great emergency. But that's what you learned. My own background, frontier background, you're prepared. You have to stay prepared. And if you're prepared, then you see what we did. There's something called an accident sequence. And there's seven steps dealing with accidents, with intense drilling on an accident sequence. And the key to that is what's called a trigger. That is an analogy of a gun, right? Nobody can shoot you if they don't pull the trigger. So you look around for triggers. And people get very, very good at this. Uh-huh. And the trigger is already step four. And there's only three steps left. So... You're trained to look at the first three steps and then the trigger. And did you see a trigger to act on it, to take that trigger out or remove it? So that was using this accident, our research ship, which is now just landed in Brazil after going across the South Atlantic. So far, knock on wood, we've had pretty good luck with that. But part of it is this training of looking for the triggers and removing them before. Now, everybody in the biosphere had some training on the ship. That was a key part of the safety training.
What happened next after the first two-year mission? Everybody came out. They were healthy. You learned. You collected a lot of data. Then what?
Well, then we had a three-month period, what we called a transition, which was to gather all of the data that we could. So specialists, the man in charge of insects came in, the man in charge of this came in, or the advisor on that. Everybody came in and measured what's in there. And that data is now available to the public. It's been published by the Ecological Engineering Journal. This is quite available, and there's been peer-reviewed publications on much of that data. So that next step was to get all of the data from Mission 1, out to the scientific public and to the general public insofar as they were interested. Then Mission 2 was set up. Then I was turning 65. So that to my mind, finish my mission with Biosphere 2 and then see what would happen with it after that.
So basically you were turning it over to other people.
Yeah, well, and also the corporation actually split apart into two corporations that had Space Biosphere's venture. But basically, yeah, other people took over, and the ones that took over then, Columbia University came in. And
but what happened? I mean, I take it the second mission didn't go as well as the first.
Well, because Columbia University believed in specialists. They were fundamentally hypothesis-driven. See, that's very deep in American culture today. Why is it so popular? Because so much is patent-driven.
Right.
And you can't make a patent off a naturalist observation. You can't make a patent off a complex system the way it's written.
Yeah.
You can make it if you make some deal from a hypothesis-driven one and you show that X produces Y. You can patent that. Now, if you've cut out government expenditure and enterprises in bad odor with the intelligentsia, that means you're dependent on corporations who make money by getting patents. Ergo, I think that's a tremendous monopoly.
It's interesting. But, I mean, isn't there also, correct me if I'm wrong, but just a kind of it's easier to be a reductionist. It's easier to clean everything off and look at one little component of thing than to look at a huge, complex system.
It's easier in the sense that you can be trained. That you can train thousands, millions of people to do something like that, and you can get 23 competing pharmaceuticals to give you some kind of a chance to improve yourself slightly. Yes. But it's not easier if you look at the human cost.
Right.
It's much easier to deal on a human scale with things. But and we're talking. It depends what you mean by easier. It's easier to finance and get a direct readout on a return with reductionist science. It's much harder on human beings, though.
How is it harder on human beings? I mean, what are some of the you talk about? Not only the cost to, for example, the land through depleting the soils and so on, but also the cultural hazards and the cultural destruction that results from that kind of thinking?
Well, soil is what depletes the landscape. What depletes human beings is dumbing down for the brain, a rigid set of emotional responses, and repetitious functioning. So actually the erosion of the human is much more drastic and important and dangerous than the reduction of the soil.
It's funny, erosion is a metaphor that you use for human beings' minds.
Yeah. You see, there's that poetry coming in again. And metaphors do, and there's a lot of every metaphor within limits is true. That is, there is a little part of A in every part of B.
So we've just got a minute or two left. Where did your life go after Biosphere 2 and after your 65th birthday and you stepped away from it?
Oh, well, we're applying a lot of Biosphere. The new team to develop, which is a lot of the people in the old team, we're doing a forest, tropical rainforest reforestation of 1,000 acres in Puerto Rico. Our research ship is doing a study now of the ethnosphere, the sphere of human cultures around the planet. It's just been in Sumatra, Madagascar, South Africa, now Brazil. We have a savanna restoration project, 5,000 acres in Australia, studying that. We do an interesting project. Now this is the Institute of Ecotechnics, with another nonprofit called October Gallery in London, which people, the artists that we met on these travels around the world for ecology, there's also people who are great artists in many of these countries, and they didn't have an entree into Western Europe. So that's what October Gallery does. And then, of course, we keep up at Sinergia Ranch here in Santa Fe, work on total systems, both a small experimental unit, which we work with the Japanese, Chinese, Russians, and NASA has had sponsored a couple of meetings out there. And we also working on what I call a cybersphere, which would be a feedback system so that these different component sub-complex systems would have a feedback to each other.
John Allen is the author of Me and the Biospheres, a memoir by the inventor of Biosphere 2. He's a systems ecologist and engineer, thinker, metallurgist, adventurer, writer. It's been wonderful having you with us. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
And he will be speaking at Garcia Street Books this Friday, February 27th from 5 to 6 in the afternoon. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can reach me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We are podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Nick Appalucci for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, the Jazz Experience. Broadcasting from the studios of KSFR, my name is Mary Charlotte. We'll see you tomorrow. Ciao.